Thank you, Project Truth, guys. That was really good. So next up we have Stephanie Gray, who's giving abortion and narratives. Stephanie's an experienced debater and communicator. She's reached vast audiences through lectures and television work, using her wide experience of speaking with people affected by abortion around the world. The title of her talk today is Abortion and Narratives. So everyone, if you'd just like to welcome Stephanie. Woo!
Thank you so much. All right, well, to begin, I want us to do a little thought experiment. And I think the thought experiment is best done if we have no visual distractions. So if you're willing, I would ask that people close their eyes. And I'm going to keep my eyes closed as well. And that you keep your eyes closed until I ask you to open them. So you're going to hear some music. Keep them closed after the music until I tell you. So let's begin.
Oh, I love to sing.
Barney is a dinosaur from our imagination. By his tongue is what we call a dinosaur sensation.
Did you say sensation?
I want you to imagine that you are subjected to that song day in and day out. I want you to imagine that it greatly aggravates you, but you can't do anything about it because you cannot speak. And I want you to imagine that you cannot move away from the source of that sound coming out of a television because you're in a wheelchair. And you've been left in your wheelchair in front of the TV set. I want you to imagine, as you're sitting there listening to that annoying music, that there is a strap holding you up so you don't fall forward because you have no control over your body movement, and that strap is digging into you. It hurts. But you can't do anything about it because you're incapable of moving your limbs and no sound comes out of your vocal cords. I want you to imagine that as the day progresses, you move from watching Barney to having your shower, which of course you need someone to do for you, and the person who is in charge of showering you uses cold water. I want you to imagine they get soap in your eyes. And again, you're incapable of moving, incapable of speaking. I want you to imagine it's time to eat, and someone brings a cup of hot tea to your mouth, and you don't like to drink the tea scalding hot, but you know it's going to be hours before you drink again. And so you gulp it down. You can open your eyes. What I asked you to imagine was the real experience for a young boy from South Africa by the name of Martin Pistorius. In the late 1980s, when he was around 12 years old, Martin got flu-like symptoms. It just seemed like a normal flu. But he didn't get better. He got progressively worse, so that by the end of that first year of sickness, he was essentially sleeping 24 hours a day in a comatose state. His parents were told he had the mind of a six-month-old baby. His limbs began to curl in. He became incapable of speaking, incapable of moving. 3 years passed where Martin was in this unconscious state, but when he was close to 16 years old, Martin woke up. He woke up in his mind, but not in his body. For 10 years, Martin lived as a mind trapped in a body where he understood everything going on around him and endured the type of suffering I had you imagine, and much worse. He was brutally, physically, and sexually abused by some healthcare workers. But incapable of moving and incapable of speaking, he couldn't do anything to stop it. So how do we know all these years later that this happened to Mark? Well, we know because of an incredible person by the name of Verna. Verna was one of the people that worked at the care home. She would go around to patients with her massage oils and she would give them massages. And Martin has later described that Verna was different from so many others.
Because when Verna looked in Martin's eyes, she knew the eyes were the windows to the soul. And she believed, although he was not responding back like her colleagues were, she believed that Martin was aware inside, but regardless of whether he was, she believed he deserved to be reverenced and respected. One day, Verna, watching TV when she wasn't on her shift, had seen this program about this new computerized technology that was being developed to help people who had been stroke patients, who were no longer able to communicate verbally. And this computerized program was being developed so they could still communicate. And so Verna watched this program and she thought, I bet this would work for Martin. And so the next day when she went to work and she was massaging him, she was telling him all about it, and all Martin could do was sit in his contorted state in the wheelchair, listening to her, not responding back. But she said, Martin, I bet this would work for you, wouldn't it? So she went to his parents, became his advocate. She said, I believe your son is aware inside. You need to take him for further testing. And so they listened to her. They took him for further testing, and Martin became unlocked. He has regained the use of the upper half of his body. He enters wheelchair races. He can drive a car with his hands. He has written his autobiography, an incredibly powerful book called Ghost Boy. He has given a TED Talk. But perhaps one of his greatest accomplishments is that he moved from South Africa here to England, where several years ago he married his bride, and just a few months ago they had this baby boy. All because Verna had the eyes to see what most people did not. I wanted to begin this talk on narratives about abortion, because we're gathered here because we have the eyes to see. We're gathered here because we know the preborn child is a human person, but many people do not. And as a result, many people are mistreating preborn children the way there were people who mistreated Martin. And so the responsibility of you and me is to be like Verna, for us to become the advocates of preborn children the way Verna became the advocate for Martin. And I want to talk today about a very practical way we can do that through the power of storytelling. If you even think about my main point that I communicated just a few seconds ago, that we have the eyes to see what others don't, and we need to be advocates for preborn children the way Verna was, I could have just started my talk with that. I could have just said, hey, we're here because we know something most people don't acknowledge, and so we need to tell the world. But I think you'll agree with me, that point was made much more powerfully through the story of Martin and the story of Verna. So what I want to encourage you to do is think that anytime you're in conversation with someone, if there is a particular point you want to tell them, pause and think, how do I tell them this point through stories? Because stories grip the imagination. They cause the person to pay much more attention. And so for this presentation, I'm just going to give you story after story that I hope you'll draw on in conversation when dialoguing with people on the topic of abortion. One of the tasks we have as pro-lifers is to convince people that when the preborn child is in the one-cell state, when the preborn child is a zygote, just after sperm egg fusion, our task is to convince people that that individual is as human as all of us and worthy of the same respect and protection that all of us have. How do we convince people of that? Well, a story I often like to tell is one which references an old technology, but it's making a comeback, and that's the technology of a Polaroid camera. I realize these days we're all grabbing our digital phones and taking digital pictures. But if you think for a moment about that old technology that's often used, at least in North America, at wedding receptions, on the reception tables, and guests are told, take photos with the Polaroid camera. If you think about that technology, you get a camera and you get a stack of cards. And you put the cards in the camera and you snap a photo, and when the cards come out, what do you see initially on that first card that came out? What do you see initially? Was it really nothing? What else? What do you see? Someone said nothing. You see kind of like black marks. Then what do? You shake it, right? And in a few moments, you'll be looking on the piece of paper at exactly how you'd seen what was in front of you. So I'll often say to people, imagine you have a Polaroid camera. And imagine you're going on a little holiday with your Polaroid camera to take pictures that way. And imagine you're going to where Louise and I are going next week. I'm super excited because my dad's from Scotland. I just came here from Scotland. I was there all week. And I'm really excited to go back to Scotland because next week I'm going up to Loch Ness. Okay, that's right. I know you're probably thinking that's not a real Scottish accent, but my dad sounds like that, I swear. Right, so imagine you're coming with me and Louise to Loch Ness next week. And imagine that when you join us for our tour, we're all signed up for a boat tour of Loch Ness. Imagine that while we're taking this boat tour, you bring along the Polaroid camera. Now let's imagine a couple hours into our boat tour, we suddenly see the Loch Ness monster that my grandma many years ago swears she saw. So imagine you point the Polaroid in that direction because you're thinking to yourself, if I can prove Nessie is real, I can sell this and then make money off of it. I'll sell it to newspapers, magazines. I'll make all this money. And you think about all the things you can buy. So you're super excited about this. So you point the Polaroid in the direction of Nessie. You snap a photo and the little card comes out. Now, just as the card comes out, Nessie goes underwater. Will you be disappointed she's disappeared? No. Why? Because you've got the evidence in your hands. You're holding that picture. And let's imagine you start to shake it super excitedly, thinking about everything you'll buy. And as you're shaking it, let's imagine there's someone else on the boat tour with us who's never seen a Polaroid camera, doesn't know how the technology works. They excitedly grab the card from you to look at Nessie. But when they look at that paper, they see those black marks. They think the photo didn't take properly. So with great disappointment, they rip it and toss it in the lake. Guy in the back there would be upset. Right, imagine the Scottish temper comes out. I see we've got a ginger in the crowd. Gingers are often fiery ones. Okay, so imagine it's the ginger with the Polaroid, and they get really angry at this person for destroying the picture. And that person looks back and says, it was just black marks. Why do you care so much about black marks? And you'd likely reply, it wasn't just black marks. Everything about the image of the Loch Ness monster was captured in an instant. It just needed time to develop. And so it's that story we can draw on in conversation to make the point that, yeah, that embryo at fertilization doesn't look like you and me. The way the moment the image is captured on the Polaroid doesn't look like a few minutes later when it's finished developing. But just as the value of that image begins the moment the photo is captured, the value that all of us have today begins the moment we are captured, which is sperm egg fusion, the moment of fertilization. And we could say to someone, hey, life begins in an instant but needs time to develop, or we could tell a story that proves the point. Another story I'd like to tell you is one that involves, I find when I dialogue with people, they will often try to say, well, even if the embryo is human biologically because the parents are, the embryo isn't a person. And they will say the embryo isn't a person because a newborn baby has no recollection of their time in the womb. So they are not even conscious, they're not rational, they're not aware, so they're not persons. And so the story I like to tell people about is the story of Kim and Cricket Carpenter. Kim and Cricket Carpenter fell in love, got married, and a couple months into their marriage, they were driving down the road on a wintry night, got in a severe car accident, and they both almost died. Well, Cricket was in a coma for several weeks, and when she woke up, she had no recollection of the previous year and a half of her life. Not only that, she had to learn to walk again. She had to learn to brush her teeth again. Although she learned to walk again and she learned to brush her teeth again, she did not regain the memory of the previous year and a half, which meant she had no recollection of ever meeting, falling in love with, and marrying her husband. Over two decades later, Cricket has still never recalled those memories and fell in love with her husband again. Cricket went through a stage where she had a lot of anger, a personality that she hadn't had prior to the accident. Here's why I bring this up.
Some people might say very casually in a sentence, well, she's not the same person today that she was before the accident. But what they actually mean is she's not the same personality. There's parts of her that have changed. But we know that if we look at the wedding photo of her and Kim, that's her, even though she doesn't remember it. We know that if we go further back to her high school graduation photo, that's her, the same person. If we look back to her parents' photo album of her baby photos, again, we know that's her, the same person. And so what we see is that it's possible to maintain our identity even though we go through physical and mental changes, even if we don't even remember a portion of our existence. We're the same individual, but there are features about us that might change. And so we can use that story to then say, in the same way, yes, the one-celled embryo, the late-term fetus, even the newborn baby has no recollection of those stages. But as that individual grows up and let's say is 10 years old, we know that that 10-year-old is the same person as a 2-year-old that she was. We know that 2-year-old is the same as the infant she was that she looks at in her photo album. We know that that infant is the same baby also in the photo album as is seen as the ultrasound photo the parents put in that photo album. Even though she doesn't have recollection of it, even though her personality has developed over those 10 years, we remain the same even when we go through physical and psychological changes. You can make that point, or you could tell it through the story of Kim and Cricket. Another point as pro-lifers we often need to make is that although the preborn child is weaker than the born, that heightens our responsibility. It doesn't lessen it. Now that's the principle, but it's better communicated through a story. And I remember a few years ago that there was this teenager I was debating on abortion, and she said to me, she was quite exasperated, we'd been debating back and forth for a while, and she said, look, if you have a baby in one hand and you have a fetus in the other hand, you obviously pick the baby. And before I responded, I thought to myself what I recommend you always think when you're dialoguing with someone, and that is this: what is she telling me that she's not verbalizing? What's behind her words? And so I thought for a moment about a newborn baby versus a fetus, and I thought, any one of us could take care of a newborn baby. You know, if I brought a baby into the room and then I walked out, any one of you could pick the baby up and grab the bottle I left behind and feed the baby. But if I had a fetus in my womb, could any of you take the fetus out and care for it? No. So I knew that in a sense the fetus was weaker and the baby was stronger. Although the baby is still much weaker than all of us. In contrast to the fetus, a newborn baby is stronger, more independent. So I thought what the girl said to me without verbalizing was this: if you have a strong person in one hand and a weak person in the other hand, you obviously pick the strong person. And the moment I translated what she'd said to that, I then realized she can't even believe what she says, because civil societies always put weak people ahead of strong people, not the other way around. But I needed to prove that to her. I couldn't just say it. I mean, I could just say it, but I knew it would be more compelling through a story. So as it should happen, praying for divine inspiration, an image popped into my head, and it was this. A picture my friend had posted on Facebook many years ago. And so I said to this girl, what you just said reminded me of a picture my friend posted online. It's the type of picture that as you were scrolling past, you'd normally ignore it. It was just a picture of water, maybe a river, something curvy sticking in the middle, nothing interesting, except my friend had posted a caption right above it, and she wrote, "My husband is a hero." I'm looking at that picture and looking at the caption thinking, why? And so underneath, my friend wrote why. She said, "My husband's a paramedic. At midnight, he was called to the scene of a car accident. A woman had been driving down the road, lost control of her car. It spun out several times and landed in a nearby river. When my friend's husband got to the scene of the accident, he saw that that woman who had been driving the car was sitting on the roof of her sinking vehicle, holding her 10-month-old baby in her arms. My friend's husband jumped into the water, swam towards the car, and then realized he could only take one person at a time to shore. So I looked at this teenager I was talking with and I said, who do you think he picked first? And what do you think she said?
the baby. Now, who do you think the mom wanted him to take first? The baby, because both the paramedic and the mom realized something in that moment. The mom was stronger and the baby was weaker. And in that moment, they instantaneously calculated that when you have strength and you have weakness, you put the weakness first. And the girl's like, yeah. And I said, do you agree he made the right choice, that the mom had the right desire? She said, yeah, of course. I summarized the point. Okay, it sounds to me like you think we should put weaker people ahead of stronger people. She said, yeah. So then I connected it back to our original conversation. I said, when you talked about the baby versus the fetus and how you'd obviously pick the baby, I said, you know, a baby is stronger and more independent than a fetus, who's weaker and more dependent. And since you think when you have a strong person like the mom and the weak person like the baby, that you should put the baby ahead of the mom while still protecting the mom eventually, then wouldn't it follow that when you have a stronger individual like a baby and a weaker individual like a fetus, that we should put the weaker ahead of the stronger? She looked at me and said, you argue really well. She was almost perplexed, but I say that to communicate, that's the power of stories. I didn't just tell her the principle, put weak people ahead of strong people. I told it through the power of a story. Another example as it relates, if you go back to my point that if I left a newborn baby in the room, that any one of us in the room could care for it, you know, pro-lifers often make a similar point to the culture. We'll say to the abortion supporters, hey, a woman can place her child for adoption. And then the abortion supporter will say, well, that works if the baby's born, because if I don't want the baby, then I can give the baby up right away to a whole host of people. But when I'm pregnant, I can't place the baby for adoption yet. The baby has exclusive dependency on me. That's why I can have an abortion. Because anyone can care for an infant, but only I can care for the fetus. That's why I should be allowed to have an abortion. So whenever I hear that argument, I think to myself, well, wait a minute. She's right about her analysis, but wrong about her conclusion. Right about her analysis, but wrong about her conclusion. The fact that, indeed, the fetus will only survive with her body, that exclusive dependency exists. Rather than lessening her responsibility, doesn't it heighten it? I could just ask the question. I could state it as a conclusion, or I could tell a story. And so the story I'll tell people is this. Imagine you are trained in the Heimlich maneuver. Now, is it called the Heimlich maneuver here? I hear it's got a new phrase. It's called abdominal thrust or something. You know what I mean, the Heimlich. If someone's choking, we're all on the okay, good, not lost in translation. So let's imagine you are trained in first aid. You know the Heimlich maneuver, and you're out for lunch with a friend, and it's a very busy restaurant. And let's imagine a group of paramedics are also having lunch in that restaurant. Now let's imagine someone at another table begins to choke. Now there's a table full of paramedics. They know how to do the Heimlich maneuver. So do you. Several of them hop up, and you don't bother going over. There's the paramedics there. Indeed, they help the choking person. The person's A-okay. Did you do something wrong by staying in your seat, by not getting involved? Did you do something wrong? No, because you knew not only that there was other help, but that other help was actively participating in responding to the situation. So then I'll say to the person, let's change the story. Let's imagine you're not in a restaurant, but let's imagine you're still trained in first aid and you're really good at the Heimlich maneuver. Let's imagine you're eating with a friend at your home. And let's imagine no one is home but you and your friend. And let's imagine as your friend is eating lunch, your friend begins to choke. Now remember, you're trained in the Heimlich maneuver. You know exactly what to do. Let's imagine you don't do it. You just sit there like you did in the restaurant in the first scenario. And let's imagine they choke and die. Have you done something wrong now? Yes. So then I'll ask the abortion supporter, having told the story, what's the difference between the first variation of the story and the second? The difference was that many could help in the first case, but only you could help in the second case. And the fact that only you could help actually heightened your responsibility. It didn't lessen it. So what stories can we tell to make the pro-life principle more acceptable in people's minds? The other day, Emmett kindly got me into a Catholic high school, and I gave a presentation to some teenagers. And in the course of the discussion, one of the students asked, if the mother's life was in danger, what do you do? Is abortion allowed then? And so I answered the question by also drawing on a story. First, I communicated the principle. I said, well, since I've gone through the facts that the preborn child is human, then it means the child is equal to the mom. So we don't put them on the head of the baby nor below the baby. We say, we've got two equal human beings. How do I protect them both? And I said to her, sometimes when we intervene, we're able to protect both of them. But sometimes we lack the technology to save the baby because the baby's particularly small and, again, dependent on the mom's body. But not having the technology to save the baby is not the same thing as directly and intentionally targeting the baby's body for destruction and death. I said, that's what abortion does, and that would always be wrong. So when a woman's life is in danger, it's wrong to do that. It's wrong to take that path to achieve the end of saving the mom's life. But just because I'm saying that avenue is not open to us, it doesn't mean there aren't other things we can do to save the mom's life. And then I told my story. I said, imagine that you're driving home after school today and there's a very particular path that your parents always take to get to your family home. But let's imagine when you get close by, there's a sign up that says road closed, detour ahead. Now, Emmett told me you guys use other language here. Where's Emmett? Diverted traffic, right, say it with an Irish accent. So imagine as you're driving home, there's a sign up that says, road closed, diverted traffic. And so you can no longer take your normal path to get home. Does that mean you're not going to get home that night? No, you're going to get home, but you're going to take this road and then that road and a few more turns and a few more turns, but you eventually get home. So the point is that although one road is closed, that there are other roads that we can take. At that same event, a student said to me, shared with me a personal story. She said, my aunt had an abortion because she was told that her baby was dead. Now, it's interesting when people, at first she said she was told, she was told the baby was dead. Now, if the baby was truly dead, then it's not an abortion. Of course, you may need to remove the child if the mom isn't kind of entering into labor naturally. But if the child is dead, you're not inflicting death. But as I spoke with her a little further, she then said, well, my aunt was told the baby wouldn't live more than a couple days. So then it's like, okay, well, then if the baby could live at least for a couple days after birth, then the baby's not dead up to that point. And as we talked even further, it became clear. She said to me, well, and the baby didn't have a brain. And I said, was your aunt told that her child had anencephaly? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, well, children with anencephaly actually have a very small portion of the brain stem. They just don't have the whole brain. And yes, it's very typical that when a baby only has the lower part of the brain, that when the baby's born, the baby may die right away. Some babies in that case die before birth. Some actually live for a few hours. There was one case I'd read about, I think a baby with anencephaly lived for several months. And so I said to her, you know, what makes me sad is that your aunt was probably encouraged by the medical community that abortion was the answer to her situation because her child wouldn't live long.